Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Improving Forensic Science, an interview with Kevin Lowridge of the NFSTC, and I just mispronounced his name. It's Kevin Lothridge, and I said I wasn't going to do that before the show, and I just screwed it up, but it's Kevin Lothridge of the NFSTC. So now, everybody, here's your hosts of today's show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome, everyone. We are really pleased to have Kevin with us this evening, and not just because he has the rare achievement of being an Eagle Scout, but he has a really illustrious career in forensic science and is going to talk to us about the incredible National Forensic Science Technology Center. Kevin graduated from Eastern Kentucky University, went on to work for the Pinellas County Forensic Science Lab in Florida. He's a past president of the American Society of Crime Lab Directors. He's been an acting director at the National Institute. NIJ. What the alphabet soup is there? The National Institute of Justice. He is now the CEO of the National Forensic Science Technology Center. So thank you very much, Kevin. We're really excited to hear more about you and the center.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Doug and Jan.
Well, Kevin, thanks for being with us. It's a real treat. Why don't we start with a little background? Why don't you tell us a little bit about you and what your training experience is, and how you ended up being the CEO of the National Forensic Science Technology Center.
Well, sure, Doug. I actually, growing up as a kid, I always liked science, and I always wanted to do something that was in the public service realm, so I matched my desire for that and got a degree in forensic science from Eastern Kentucky University. Had made a deal with myself and said that if I didn't like what I was doing, I would find another challenging career, and that was many, many years ago, so I really enjoy the forensic science world, and I've been able to do lots of different things in forensic science, but really applying that logical thinking that you get by having a science degree and being able to work on things that help public safety and public service is just really important, and that's why I really enjoy forensic science, and I've never wanted to do anything else.
Cool. For people who don't know, what exactly is the National Forensic Science Technology Center?
The National Forensic Science Technology Center is a 501c3 not-for-profit that actually is stood up to support forensic science providers. It doesn't do any casework. It actually does tools, it builds tools and does training to support those people providing forensic services.
So how did this organization get started?
Well, since you're coming to us from California, you'll know this quite well. There's a famous case out there called the O.J. Simpson trial. As O.J. was driving his Bronco down the 5, the American Society of Crime Lab Directors realized that the scrutiny that forensic science was going to get was probably greater than they had ever seen before. They were meeting to look at a transitioning Department of Energy facility, which happens to be located in Largo, Florida, where we're located. And they said, it looks like we're going to have to do something that's different than the volunteer organizations we've got. So they actually incorporated the nonprofit, the National Forensic Science Technology Center. They gave it $1,500 and the mission to go do good things. Well, in 1995, there were no $99 LLCs that stood up nonprofits. So we took the $1,500, spent $1,475 of those dollars to do the proper incorporation of a nonprofit in the state of Florida. Then we took the other $25 and got some adult beverages and figured what good things we were going to do because we had nothing else left at that point. So from that $1,500 investment, if you look at the history, we're going into our 20th year. It's very rare for nonprofits that are not well supported when they stood up to survive 20 years of going for soft money. We've grown from that $1,500 to currently 38 full-time employees, revenues around $16 million a year, solely focused on biometric and forensic intelligence and service.
Hmm. So another thing that I think happens with successful nonprofits of this nature anyway is that they answer some real need or address some real problem. So what are some of the problems and needs that the center was created to address?
Well, if we go back to look at 1995 and the O.J. Simpson trial and the case that went there, it was the first time that the public ever saw forensic testimony on TV. And it was across-the-board forensic testimony. It wasn't just crime lab stuff. There was medical examiner's things. There were other activities that were being testified on. And they went to video of the crime scene to refute what somebody said they did or did not do. Also in 1995, not many of the labs in the United States were accredited. So one of the things that ASCLAD really supports is quality services in forensic science. You know, we're science serving justice. That's our tagline for the NFSTC. So when we first got started back in the mid-90s to the late 90s, we really focused on doing quality service processes, helping laboratories do their own internal audits, putting on nationwide quality assurance training programs. So when you think about the goal, which was to make sure that the public has the confidence in all the forensic services, that goes across the board. When we started out the NFSTC, we were looking at 425 crime labs. That number hasn't changed much. And if you think about a business that is a niche of a niche that concentrates to 425 customers, that's pretty hard to sustain. So over the years, we morphed and added other forensic service providers into the services we provided. And so for us, we're really making sure the same goals are ours 20 years later, which is that the public has the full confidence in all forensic services provided. And as you know, there's not a lot of good news stories when you Google forensic science these days.
Mm-hmm. I remember I watched voraciously the O.J. trial, but back when Court TV existed, which was like a black letter day when it died. I loved Court TV. I was a junkie. And I was there watching, and they did those 4 or 5 days of DNA, and I, even after they finished, I didn't understand it. And I said, oh, please, just let me come up there with a chalkboard and give me 30 minutes. So who is the center designed to help? I mean, who are the people that you reach out and do the work for?
We actually were stood up to support the people doing the operational work that you saw in the O.J. Simpson trial. So because we don't do operational work, we support those people whose day job is to get resolution of that evidence that is submitted to all forensic service providers. Now, when you concentrated on the O.J. Simpson trial, they really looked at really the evidence post it being collected. Now, if we think about where a lot of the work, because the technology 20 years later is much better, we're looking at crime scene people who are collecting evidence, doing some type of documentation or preparing things. Then it goes to another level, let's say the laboratory in an accredited facility, doing the full work. So we're stood up to support across the board state and local law enforcement, the federal government, the international community, and DHS and DOD.
Cool. Let's talk a little bit more about that and what you actually do and how you've helped improve forensic science and forensic science services. A little bit about your analyst training programs for the practitioners who are down in the dirt and actually doing the job and things like DNA and toxicological testing and crime scene, firearms, latent prints, et cetera. How do you actually bring that educational model and help those people?
Well, if you, Doug, you mentioned you watched those 5 days about DNA evidence and how difficult it was. If you think about 1995, there were not a lot of DNA laboratories in the United States. The technology used then was very difficult. And as the adoption and knowing that DNA was going to be a critical factor for providing scientific support to the investigation of crimes, there was a need to put together a standardized training program. We were fortunate enough to get some funding from the National Institutes of Justice in the early 2000s to build what you would consider a forensic DNA academy. People say, well, why do you call it an academy? Most of the people who are the users of forensic science are in law enforcement, if you're talking about state and local law enforcement, and we're talking about the year 2000. What does every law enforcement officer have to do? They go to the academy, right?
Yep.
They go to a standard training program. They have field training officers. So we sequence, because our background, the original executive director of the NFSTC was Dr. Bill Tillstone, and he was an academic by training, and he ran a crime lab in Adelaide, Australia, and came up here to work with me. And he was the first director, the first full-time paid employee of the NFSTC. And he understood the educational need to make sure that everybody that was performing the work had the background and underpinning, because universities teach knowledge. They don't always teach hands-on practical things. So when we stood up the training programs, we stood them all up to be a 16-week concentrated training program. So in the original DNA training that we did, we also got the students graduate college credit because of the rigor that we put into the training. That lives on today if you ever go to the NIJ website and see DNA analyst training. That's the work that we did that's out there for people to take. It's not a face-to-face anymore. It's actually an online course because you need to have a blended approach. And as we went across all the training, people couldn't be away from home or work for 16 weeks. So we had to do some modifications of the program. And these programs have peer-reviewed content, basic science for the areas of firearms and drug chemistry, DNA, latent fingerprints, and crime scene. In the later time, we actually sequenced the fingerprint training, which nobody had done before, with our partner Ron Smith and Associates, and were able to get the students in a short period of time. We did this in a six-month program. Typically, some of these training programs were two-year apprenticeships, if you will, mentor-trained. And we were able to condense that down to 6 months where these students could set, after completing all the training, could set for the pre-IAI certification test and do very, very well on that. So
we
our
should
training
maybe, I was just going to say, we should probably mention for people who don't know what IAI is.
Sure. The IAI is the International Association for Identification, and they really cover a lot of the disciplines like crime scene, latent fingerprint, shoe and tire print, photography, and they have certification programs. Because, again, the things we're talking about, laboratory accreditation, is not wholly mandated across the United States. It's only voluntary. Some states have made it mandatory. Individual certification is not mandatory. So anybody that passes these, it just shows that they've had an independent review of their work or they've had an independent review of their laboratory. So I'll try not to use too many three-letter names.
It's hard,
yes. Well, as part of that mission that you created for yourself, one of the things that you produced is the crime scene guide. Tell us about that.
We actually took an existing crime scene guide that NIJ had done. They had a series of guides in the late 90s and early 2000s. And what we did was we saw that there was a need because more advanced technology and more field work was being done. So we took that work based on peer review work, got other people to review it, and put together a new crime scene guide, which is much more extensive than the old guide, and it's also being used as base training, which is what you really need. We need to have some standards across all forensic services, and if we can get that baseline standard, you can modify it up for people that need to do additional things, or use that as a tiered approach to see how your analysts will do things. Not everybody does every technique. But the crime scene guide, which you can find on our website, is being used in ways that we didn't think about it. There's a lot of international pickup for it because they're hungry for information. And we're also seeing it being integrated into some agencies' training programs as, I don't want to say a handbook like the Fisher Guide to the Crime Scene, but more of a practical guide that they can take forms and things out of and use in their daily processes if their agency didn't already have a fully developed crime scene program.
Yeah, I want to talk to you more about some of the other things as soon as you're doing, but I just want to take a moment longer on what you've been talking about so far, because I think some of our listeners have heard us mention in other shows about the National Academy of Sciences study of forensic science, and we'll link to that again for this show. But just I think a lot of people have this picture that forensic science is very uniform, that there are national standards, that the language used across in terminology is the same everywhere, that there are consistent protocols, and that it's really something that's sort of grown up in each jurisdiction and is governed very differently from place to place. So it sounds like part of what you're doing is trying to help bring all of that to a higher and more consistent level of quality.
Well, and that goes, Jan, that goes back to our beginning. Where we where we were stood up was to be an organization that was inclusive, to bring together the best and help the people who are daily workers in this. If, at the end of the day, if we're not helping the people in the laboratories or the people in the military, then we're not doing our job. So we should be trying to do this coordination, or at least trying to pull together some baseline standards or protocols, or provide the training that there's a gap for. Sometimes we go out and work with other partners who already have a training program, and we integrate it into a much larger overall training program because we can identify the gap and fill the gap. It doesn't mean we always have to do it ourselves.
Right. Well, I remember when I first started learning about forensic science and spending time with forensic scientists and going to academy meetings, how shocked I was to learn that we didn't have a particular kind of database that was very important. And one of the things I feel you must be very proud of is your role with NAMIS. Tell us about NAMIS and what it does.
Yeah, it's interesting. In running a nonprofit organization, and I mentioned about my background about doing things that were science and response, publicly responsible and ensuring the public safety, it's once in a lifetime that you get to write on a white piece of paper this concept of NAMIS and be awarded to build the program and see the resolution of 30-year-old cases where sisters know where their missing sister went, and unfortunately their mother went to her grave not knowing where her daughter was. So the National Missing Unidentified Persons System is a program that's just that. It matches unidentified remains with missing persons. It goes on today. It started in 2007. We're in 2014, and it's resolving cases right now. This is a testament to the National Institute of Justice for working with their varied user community. One of the most frustrated groups was the National Association of Medical Examiners, because guess what? It's their job to identify those decedents who end up in their offices. Without a system like this, you would never know that 30 miles away there was a missing person. But it also goes back to this lack of everything being treated the same. If you have a case where there's an unidentified dead and the agency that is responsible for those remains don't take fingerprints or don't have a way to search those fingerprints in a national database, it's very difficult to have resolution. I heard one time that if a person was unknown in life, it's highly unlikely they'll be identified in death, and we don't want that. That is not satisfactory in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a lot of people that come from outside the United States that, without tools like DNA, fingerprint, facial recognition, identification of belongings, without a system like NAMIS, they would remain unidentified in someone's unmarked grave. And And really, the Nameless program has done a tremendous amount of work. And the people that run it now at the University of North Texas Health Science Center do a great job in getting that same work out. And it's a very, very important program to maintain. One of the concerns I have is it's still a government program, and you have to worry that if government funding runs out, will someone step in and pick up this very, very important program and maintain it?
Well, I think that one of the great things about it is that it, I think there have been some previous attempts. I remember before Nameless was around, you know, people would, you know, talk about FBI databases that people reported to, but it was so unsatisfactory for the average citizen who was out there because they were just not able to get into that system.
And really, Nameless being public-facing, the best data you get is because the people themselves who are interested in this can put that accurate data in there. If you look at the quality of data system that's built into Nameless, there are cases where there's a little bit of information that somebody put in. Then there are cases that are people looking for missing loved ones that have tons of information, which when you run across those to match them up, gives a higher likelihood of identifying them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's to me, it's once in a lifetime that you get to work on a program like that. I can tell you that every person that worked at the NFSTC as we were building and standing this up shared in the success of every resolution of one of those cases. Because that's why you work at nonprofits, is to carry out that mission. And when you see that somebody identified their sister and were able to put them in context, what happened to them, that there was resolution and they were properly buried or had a service for them, that's a great thing.
Right. Yeah, that's, I think, for me anyway, those cases are always so heartbreaking. And in some ways, you know, people would say, well, you know, would you want to know that your loved one was murdered or died alone? I can tell you, you talk to anyone who's had a missing family member and been through the torture of wondering day after day after day, what's happened to my sister, my daughter, my son, you know, it's unbelievable. If you guys had only solved one case, it would be, you know, amazing. But it's been much more successful than that. So it's such a great program. I'm so glad it's there.
Well, and I think the program itself, it transitioned from our organization to another organization, never missed a beat because the people involved in it are dedicated to that program. You know, we talk about how cases are investigated or crimes are solved. Not only is it the case of the missing and unidentified being identified, but you can also use this to help with cold cases and other things where you can get some resolution and maybe prevent a crime, which is what we really should be looking at.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the other things that NFSTC offers?
Well, we do a large number of things, as we were discussing earlier. We provide DNA audit programs to the laboratories. The FBI quality assurance system requires that every other year the public DNA labs that provide service must have an external DNA audit. Up until 2011, we did that with funding from the federal government. Now the labs are on their own to pay for that. And that program is really important because it gives that review of the work that's being done in those laboratories, making sure that everything's still working and that they have the manuals, the training, safety, all the people have the proper background to perform that very important work that we read about every day in the newspaper. So when we hear things about backlogs or other things, those do occur. And I believe in one of your other shows you talked to Max Halk about the business of forensic science. You have to have all these processes in place to be able to provide a good quality service. And that sometimes slows down the number of cases you can do. So this DNA audit program is meant to go in, be as informative as possible, because this report has to go to the government so that they can upload those profiles into the DNA database and then search other profiles against that. And that's how you get resolution. It's not... you.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, once you get that DNA profile, that's only part of the whole process that goes on to identify anybody by using DNA.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk to you about that and some of the other activities. So we'll be back in just a moment.
All right.
I thought we both had tried.
Welcome back, everybody, after the break here again with Crime and Science Radio, again with your host Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show, of course, is called Improving Forensic Science, an interview with Kevin Lothridge of the NFSTC. So now, here's your host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome back, everyone, and thank you again, Kevin, for being with us. We wanted to talk about, with the National Forensic Science Technology Center, also helps the military and has forged some new relationships with forensic science providers in other parts of the world. So can you tell us what are some of the ways that it does that?
Well, when we started 20 years ago, we were really core focused on the state and local crime laboratories, as I mentioned earlier. In the last several years, the use of forensic and biometric technology by the Department of Defense, by the Department of Homeland Security, and other folks has grown. And so since we were a training, test, and evaluation organization, we were able to apply what we had learned for state and local law enforcement, state and local crime laboratories, for the military. And so over the last several years, we've been working on projects that transitioned very high-tech tools to use by our military as well as other countries. And so those tools allow them, the military folks, to resolve issues just like we would from a crime scene. So if you think about it, we're really trying to do characterization of materials. We're trying to link events to events, people to people. So we just take those very sophisticated tools, apply them to our Department of Defense, who use them in their normal daily operations.
Well, in these programs and relationships that you've developed through your center, what are some of the things that you've learned about forensic science needs and challenges that have improved or you aren't expecting, or they popped up and you thought, wow, we're really doing something good here?
Well, I will tell you this. If somebody would have told me when I graduated from Eastern Kentucky University that 30 years later I would be taking that same technology that I learned about and then I went on to get operational training and applying it to people who are very motivated operators, they're not what we consider scientists, I would have said, what are you guys, crazy? But what we've learned is people that understand the right and left parameters for the use of materials are extremely good because they're task-focused on getting data that can then be reviewed at a higher level by people who are traditionally trained scientists. I have seen some of the most unbelievable work done by these folks that we've trained. And the same thing goes to people who are very dedicated to crime scene technology. They develop latent fingerprints because that's their job, is to develop latent fingerprints. They're not doing several other things. So when you look at those gaps, it's, we had this really sophisticated equipment in the laboratory. Can we find something that's almost as good, that is a little more rugged, doesn't require so much maintenance, and still can be used by people who are not conventionally trained scientists, degreed scientists? And that's really been one of the interesting things for us, because when we started looking at tools and technologies, if we think about forensic science as a whole, we're about 1/10 of 1% of any business's targeted focus marketing, meaning that a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer wasn't built just for forensic science. It was built for chemical analysis and applied to forensic science. And by nature, forensic science is an applied science, meaning that people typically don't build things just for forensic science. They have a side benefit of being useful for forensic science. And so being able to take the portable forensic tools into the field, giving these motivated people a way to get information, and then share that information back with somebody who can pull it all together and give you the so what, has been a really overwhelmingly positive thing. And we can also see it how it's applied to state and local laboratories. So just one of those examples would be, we did a program for state and local law enforcement called FIDO, which was the Field Identification Drug Officer. It's kind of based on SWIG drug, which is the Scientific Working Group on Drugs of Abuse. And it's a Chinese menu. You have presumptive tests like colorimetric tests, which only gives you an indication of what might be there. Then you have tests that are conclusive for what's there. We were able to take that same program, apply it to our folks in the military, and they were able to actually identify substances using colorimetric testing, handheld instruments that are spectroscopy-based, like Raman and FTIR, Fourier Transform Infrared Spectroscopy, and then using the gold standard, gas chromatography mass spectrometry, to conclusively identify the substances they had. We turned it around after we did this with DOD, and we put this same technology in the hands of the Utah Department of Public Safety. And they had their officers actually running drug analysis on the same equipment. And what that did was it freed up other resources within the Utah Department of Public Safety to do violent crimes. It reduced their backlog, and it was very, very, very important. And there are several other cities and states around the country that are doing a similar program, but wouldn't it be nice to give them this gold standard so that when they were doing a narcotics investigation and it required a time-sensitive thing, they could get a result, it could be checked by the lab, and they could go through the whole legal process. We understand the ROI on that is really good because equipment's a one-time purchase, but people's time is an ongoing expense. So that's one of the biggest things we found.
Let me ask a follow-up on that. I'm a big NASA guy. I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, so I had a space program in my backyard. I thought everybody did as a kid. And many years ago, I visited the Marshall Space Flight Center and visited Dr. Lisa Monaco, who is in their LOCAD lab on a chip thing. And she's got stuff roving around Mars right now. Have you done work with NASA using this lab on a chip technology? Has your center done any relationship with what they do? Because they're big on forensic science stuff.
We have not, because mainly we have to deal with COTS material right now, the commercial off-the-shelf.
Right.
I believe there are other agencies in the federal government that have worked with NASA technology before. And any of those things where it can be commercialized from NASA down to where they can buy multiples, because one of the things we also have to do is do a side-by-side comparison of that technology with another one that's currently being used to make sure that it's got the same capabilities or better. But one of the things in the current environment is it also has to have a negative cost delta, meaning that it has to cost less, because that's a real important thing when you're
sure.
talking about buying a large number of these. Now, NASA has done some great things to make these handheld instruments available to the public.
Right.
So the tools and things that they did by making things smaller, cheaper,
right.
and faster are in there, but we have not directly worked with any of the folks at NASA. Other than we looked at a lot of the things that they did on X-ray fluorescence from a distance or on the rovers, and now you're seeing those tools being commercially available.
Right. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. When we say things like lab on a chip, when you get to that point where you're seeing some of the things that you see being crowdsourced and funded for things like the breathalyzer that goes into your smartphone,
yeah.
Think about everybody having a Raman spectroscopy device to know if their cheese is moldy or not. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things, and I don't want to geek out or anything, but that the NFSTC, the most important thing to us is science. That's in our name, and so when we get to see this technology and understand it, then we are able to build programs around it to transition it to people who are going to use it on a daily basis.
Well, sure, and I mean, in the terrorism world, I mean, that's important. I mean, one of the things that Dr. Monaco gave, she handed me a little plastic thing about the size of a graham cracker, and she said there's 100,000 channels in there. You can do 100,000 experiments. She said it's unbelievable. It's called microfluidics and all that. Interesting.
Yep.
They use horseshoe crab blood. Go figure. But anyway, the point is that she said you could have a handheld device that you can go screen areas and look for things like sarin gas and things like that. And that fits right into what you're doing.
Well, right, because if you have more end users of forensic service beyond the laboratory, then you have to have things like Dr. Monaco is working on.
right,
or the things that we put out there, because they're not going to have a laboratory, right? By nature, they're going to be at the point of collection.
Exactly.
It's almost like you don't see cash registers anymore, right? You go to some stores and they whip out their little tablet device and you slide your credit card in there. Well, that's at the point of collection, right? Everything is done right there. That's the same thing with any of this forensic science, forensic service technology.
Exactly.
And so we're always looking for those things. Sometimes it doesn't have to be bleeding edge, because that's cutting edge. Sometimes we like to say that sometimes we would rather be the settlers than the pioneer, because the difference is the pioneer built a house, and after they died off, the settlers went in and lived in them. So we would prefer that second part to that. But because it has to be endearing, because the scrutiny of the public who look at forensic science now, they're asking really sophisticated questions, because we have done a good job of educating them. Some of the other things we've seen since the NFSTC started is decreased funding for training.
Mm-hmm.
It's all cyclic. We've been around 20 years, so we've been through several cycles. One thing we know is when the training dollars go down, they have to come back up at some point in time, because there's usually some huge gap or some issue. We've seen that other scientific organizations are interested in forensic science. Jan mentioned the National Academy of Science. There have been several reviews of forensic science. The key thing there that they're looking at is the fusing of the real hard fundamental science, which we didn't have anything focused on for us for years, to the applied sciences. And so I think that's something I've seen change. But really, the increased public interest in forensic science is overwhelming to me. If you would have told me when I was in college that there would be a series of TV shows that are related to what I was going to do, I would have said, really? I mean, there was Quincy. Now, we'll give it that. That's the precursor of all forensic science TV shows. And I think that's just one of the big changes we see.
Yeah, for better or worse. I mean, I think on the whole for better, although at times it does make, I know some of your colleagues want to put their head through plate glass windows, but I think, on the whole, one of the things that I've realized talking to people is that the average bear out there is starting to realize that there may be some need to invest in higher quality here, and to not just say, oh, that's the lab over there. And, I do believe more members of the public are beginning to realize, how many untested kits, and granted that whole situation gets oversimplified, but as they learn, that you've got tens of thousands of untested rape kits, then people need to be able to explain how that happened,
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And I have to agree with you. I think the TV shows, I mean, if you think about when I got into forensic science, or before the NFSTC was incorporated, there were not 200 hours a week of edutainment, right? I mean, it's education and entertainment, because if they were watching what we did as a forensic scientist every day, it wouldn't be quite as interesting.
No.
And it really is, and it has helped on the whole. Some of the things that it's made people believe, that's our job as the forensic science profession. The forensic industry needs to tell them, that's TV, this is reality. And it's a clear, delineation. You don't get someone's address from their DNA profile.
You mean a hologram doesn't come up showing you exactly what they look like?
And your entire medical record.
and not to mention the little beeping GPS thing that tells you exactly where you can find them. That's always my favorite. Stay in the jurisdiction, for starters.
or any of the other things where they name the wrong equipment for what they're doing, they try to get it right. It's edutainment. But the more interesting thing is, people know, if I was on a plane 30 years ago and said I was a forensic scientist, they'd say, oh, okay. If I said I was Sam that helped Quincy, the people that watch TV would know then. I don't ever say I'm a forensic scientist or work in the forensic industry anymore, because then they start asking questions about who did what, when, where, and how do we do this, how do we solve this, or you hear a personal story, which you sometimes don't want to hear. But the interesting thing is, when you say forensic scientist, people recognize what that means.
Now, when I first started taking classes in it, I was asked seriously if that meant I was taking a class about debate, because they knew the word forensic, you know, as being the debate team. So, I mean, it has a relation, but you know, I hear you. Well, let's talk about some of the other things you're on. What are your current programs that you're doing now?
Well, we, in an effort, knowing that there was a decrease in funding for people to come to face-to-face or even blended learning classes, we put some online courses together, which are based in really hard science. They're really meant for people who want to know the next level, and they cover areas like crime scene, forensic biology, digital photography, just more for people to have out there. So the crime scene is a introduction and intermediate. We've had a great uptake on this. It's not very expensive. It's $129. And we've had people all over the world take this program because it's as they need to do it. And it's got some really good background information. And we've had a lot of people take the series of four, which was surprising to us because we didn't know how well it was going to go, because there's a lot of online programs, but we've really structured ours to make sure that the science is in there and that they understand what they're actually doing. It's not that you're going to learn how to not commit a crime. It's actually you're going to learn what the things are and what people pick up and what the real professional does there. So some people
I'm sorry. I was just going to ask, are those available to the public, or do you need to be in a law enforcement agency to take them, or
these are wide open to anybody. There's no limits.
All right. You hear that, listeners?
Yeah. Go to our website and you can find out about them. And if you have any questions, you can always reach out to our folks at the NFSTC. And like I started to say, we've had people who are using this to supplement their own agency's training. So we've had groups of agencies buy seats for their employees. Mm. We still do a large amount of instructor-led training, and a lot of this is focused for our Department of Defense customers, meaning that we do a series of 5, 10, 15, or 20-day programs of instruction on all areas of forensic science, from just collection and preservation of evidence all the way through doing full-blown chemistry or learning how to do media exploitation, meaning that they can take data off computers or cell phones. And that's all at our location in Largo. We have a 80,000 square foot facility that actually has operational training space in it. So when we say you're going to learn how to run a gas chromatograph max spectrometer, we have several of those for people to use.
Great.
I'd already mentioned DNA laboratory audits. Again, that's something we provide for DNA laboratories. We do a lot of consulting, and the consulting these days is a lot different than it used to be. We do test and evaluation of technology for companies, so it's late alpha, early beta for their own internal purposes. We help talk about appropriate equipment for people to use, training programs, laboratories. If you need somebody to come in and look at your processes, we can do that. We do a lot of support directly to the laboratories in a consulting fashion. I talked about the DOD training, and what that really is a more tactical crime scene training, meaning that they're in a environment that's a little tougher than our state and local law enforcement areas, but they still need to use the same processes, because it depends on where they're at, if it's a rule of law issue or if it's actually an active military engagement. They still have to use those processes, because down the road, somebody's going to review what was done at that time. So since 2006, we started doing that. We actually did the first deployable forensic labs. And Jane, I don't know if you ever saw one when you were at one of the academy meetings, but we had those foldable 3-in-1 Connexes, which were fully equipped and can go anywhere to provide forensic service. Yeah, so we did that for the Defense Threat Reduction Agency as a program, and we were able to actually look and test different technologies that were fieldable. So there are certain things that are meant to be in a hardened facility like a laboratory, and then there's technologies that you can put in these deployable laboratories, and you try to make sure that there's no loss of capability. through there. And we do some biometrics training. We do some forensic and biometric intelligence work also.
Well, tell us a little bit about Forensic Science Simplified. What's that all
well,
about?
Well, I just got done talking about all the hard science stuff that we do. And Forensic Science Simplified came out of the Bureau of Justice Assistance saying that their clients, law enforcement, lawyers, judges, everybody wanted something that was explainable. So if you go to the website, ForensicScienceSimplified.org, you can find that there is a module on several different areas of forensic service that's meant for the introductory reader. So if you haven't been there, it's extremely well done. It's a wealth of knowledge. We had international reviewers for the data. We had it all worked together and peer-reviewed, so it's good basic information. And it's not so deep that you're going to be an expert. It's really the introductory piece, or, hey, I got a question about how do you do drug analysis. This will tell you how you do drug analysis.
Well, what other programs do you offer the public to who want to know more about forensic science?
We actually, anything on our website is open to the public.
Okay.
So there's we have things on firearms training. We have a lot of, we do a forensic update every few weeks, which is a video. We have a YouTube channel, which is a video of current topics, things like what's familial DNA searching, or how do we use new rapid DNA technology. You've heard of rapid DNA technology, which means it goes from hours down to, you know, 90 minutes. So that's something that we do for the public, and it's not really meant for the lab folks. It's really meant for the general public who have an interest in what's really the current stuff going on. And we have the capability to do that in-house, so we do.
That's great. Well, we always try to encourage members of the public to make efforts to improve forensic science in their local jurisdictions. So what do you recommend for our listeners who want high-quality forensic science services in their jurisdictions? What should they be doing?
Well, I think they need to look at to see if there's referendums or budgets or bond issues being passed that deal with forensic service or things like that, and try to understand them and see if they can support those. Because I think one of the difficulties of all the things we saw on TV is they never have a budget issue and they never have a backlog and they solve everything in 44 minutes. Well, that's not always the case, because sometimes labs struggle. If you Google closed forensic labs for the last year, you would find that there are several labs that either closed down due to poor performance or lack of funding or just a host of political related issues. So the general public should try to understand that. If the lab's doing something that needs their support, they should try to pitch in and help with that. I think one of the interesting things we talked about, backlogs of all kinds of cases, the latest ones have been sexual assault cases, should kind of be aware of what's going on with that. Don't go in and put in pressure. If you use a way to help with that, do so. Most of the labs can't take direct public support. it's difficult, but they certainly do like to know that the people that they're providing services for understand that they're doing a good job. And so if they have National Forensic Science Week and they offer tours, go. Call them up if you ever want something. They may not let you in, but I'm sure they'll embrace your questions.
Well, you talked about how you can help the public. How can the public help you? What can our listeners do to help you do your job?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to follow our social media. We have Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube. Get included in our monthly news updates. We have a lot of good information at least we think it's good information for the folks out there. It's not too technical. It's really meant to be informative in nature. I think not only for us, but if people can follow the social media for their local law enforcement, they might be the set of eyes that actually saw the person somebody was looking for. And I can tell you a local case here in Pinellas County in Largo, Florida, where they use social media and their facial recognition to be able to get a guy who robbed a bank before he got back to his house. Because they were able to put the picture out on social media, they ran it through facial recognition and were able to match it to a driver's license. People said, yep, that's him, he's not home yet. They waited for him, and he had a bad day. So, I mean, I think that's really, really important, is that when we have these tools, people should be aware of them, not just kind of bypass them. One of the other things we have is, if you go to our website, we participate as a nonprofit in Amazon Smile. So if you actually are a big user of Amazon and you go through the Amazon Smiles website and choose the NFSTC as your charity, a small percentage of the approved purchases you make turns right back around to us, and we turn those back into supporting our STEM programs. And we do some things for the community. We do a two-week ROTC, Reserve Officer Training, forensic and biometric internship every summer, or because those are the future leaders of the military, and so we want them to appreciate what they're doing. It also helps them choose what career they may want to take in the military, maybe military intelligence, military police, chemical corps, or anything like that.
You may also be looking at people who are future lab workers after they're done with their service too, I'm assuming.
Well, and we do that right now. We want to work on a program which allows the people who go through our military training to get some experiential learning and get college credit for that.
Cool.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much. This has been so informative. I really encourage our listeners to check on our site for the links to the National Forensic Science Technology Center, or you can just Google the NFSTC and .org. You should get there. It's a fabulous site with lots of resources. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great show.
Thanks very much.
Well, Jan and Doug, thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.